It's time for Capital Thinking, where we analyze the key policy, political, legal, and business issues that will shape America's future. Live from Washington, D.C., this is your unfiltered tour of the halls of power. Now, here's your host, Kevin O'Neill.
All right, welcome to Capital Thinking. It is a historic week in Washington, D.C. It may be cold, wet, dreary on much of the eastern seaboard, but for most Americans, they're waking up feeling pretty good about the Democratic process here this week that has turned in a historic candidate for president. Barack Obama, president-elect, will be sworn in January 20th as our 44th president. As I walk around the halls, there's euphoria among my Democratic friends and a little bit of gloom and doom from my Republican friends. I thought it was a great class exit by McCain on Tuesday night and a great entrance as president-elect for Barack Obama. Now, we're going to spend the next few weeks talking a lot about the future agenda of President Obama and the new, more strongly Democratic 111th Congress. This week, we're going to start with three key issues. That's energy, health care, and the financial world. And our first guest is Jeff Turner from the law firm of Patton Boggs, where Jeff is an expert in energy and tax issues in the legislative arena. Jeff, welcome to Capital Thinking.
Thank you.
Jeff, let's get right to it. You've put together some information on where the next Congress is headed on a lot of issues and want to talk about energy. I filled up for 215 last night, and that's way down from what it was earlier this summer. And so I guess I want to start by asking, has Barack Obama's job in changing the energy agenda gotten a lot harder now that gas prices have gone down and people aren't as concerned about it as they were earlier this year?
No, Kevin, I don't think so. During the campaign, President-elect Obama emphasized that developing a new energy policy would be one of his highest priorities. I think in the third presidential debate, when asked, he said it would be his number one priority. So we fully expect that in the first 100 days of his administration, he will put forward a comprehensive energy bill, and that he has a very good prospect for getting the Congress to agree with him. And I think that that his task will have been made easier because of the efforts of T. Boone Pickens, who I'm sure many of the listeners are familiar with the Pickens plan. I think that what
it'd be hard to be on watch TV and have missed
right.
His commercials this fall.
What I think Pickens has done, which is very important, is to help the American public and members of Congress understand that we're spending $700 billion a year, an amount that is growing. That is going abroad for principally oil from the Middle East. In this environment, I think members of Congress are now beginning to look at the energy problem from a national perspective. You know, for many years we've looked at issues from either the NIMBY philosophy, which I'm sure everybody knows is not in my backyard, but what has been emerging lately is a banana mentality. Build absolutely nothing anywhere near anyone. I think now there's a recognition that we need to do more here. We need to exploit the resources we have in the continental United States, in Alaska, offshore, and we ought to be working with our friends in Canada to develop oil sands and the potential energy reserves that country has to offer for.
Jeff, the banana acronym's certainly one of my favorite political terms. Is it more difficult, though, for this Congress and this president to tackle some of those issues, given the fact that a lot of the groups that are pro-banana, if you will, tend to be Democratic-leaning groups?
I think so, and I think that's where President-elect Obama has an opportunity to lead, and I think people will defer to him. Again, I go back to, with Pickens having put a number on the cost of our maintaining that philosophy for too long, I think when you're talking about spending upwards of $10 trillion over the next decade, sending it abroad, the focus will be what can we do here. You saw in the last days before the Congress adjourned an effort to finally deal with the issue of drilling in the outer continental shelf.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit more about about drilling. It would seem, I think, to most Americans, like a more Democratic Congress would mean less support for drilling, be it in the Arctic or offshore. Where do you see, it seemed like that was a temporary patch that Congress addressed before they got out for Election Day. Where do you see the next steps there in Congress and the White House?
One of the reasons the Democratic House had to do the patch, as you call it, is because they recognized that the moratorium on offshore production if extended yet again, would have led to a major problem with getting a budget in place. And so as of today, the moratorium has been lifted. Democrats decided to come back after the election and try to address the issue. They're looking at doing something next year on a going-forward basis that would be a permanent change to the law. Even though you have more Democrats in Congress now, I think you'll have new leaders coming to the Senate in particular who are going to try to find common ground with moderate Republicans. And I think you'll see them putting together a proposal that would allow for more offshore drilling with appropriate environmental safeguards, with revenue sharing for the states that opt into the program, but as part of a larger plan. I think that's the key point here, that Obama and Biden, through their energy plan, and Senator Obama certainly throughout the campaign, emphasized the need to do something comprehensively. And I think it's in that context that you could see a new OCS drilling provision. I think you would see an expansion of the electric transmission grid. I think you'll see more emphasis on renewable energy. And for example, the Obama-Biden New Energy for America plan, if it were enacted, would invest $150 billion over the next 10 years to create 5 million new green jobs. They would put 1 million plug-in hybrids on the road by 2015. They want to develop new low-emission coal plants. They want to create an advanced biofuels infrastructure. So they clearly have a vision of something quite comprehensive, and it's in that environment that I think you'll have the opportunity for members to step forward and say, look, it's great to save, it's great to do renewables, but we got plenty of oil offshore. We've got plenty of resources in Canada. We've got plenty in Alaska, not anymore.
So you see some legislative swapping down the line on these issues.
Yes, but again, a comprehensive bill.
You didn't mention nuclear in sort of the Obama-Biden energy plan there. I'm just wondering about that. And also, you mentioned coal, but coal sort of became an issue right at the end of the race.
Well, right.
Both Biden and Obama comments that seem to be taken in some parts as anti-coal. What about that?
Two things. On nuclear power, President-elect Obama has said that he would like to keep it as an option, but he says no more reactors should be built until we find a way to safely dispose of commercial nuclear waste. I think that means that that's not a real option in the near term in terms of his perspective. Second, on coal, remember he is from the state of Illinois, and he, in fact, supported the 2005 energy bill that in part promoted clean coal technology. I think he is a strong supporter of the coal industry. What he would like to see built are new low-emission coal plants. He'd like to see carbon capture and sequestration used to deal with the carbon emissions otherwise associated with burning coal. So I think that people will be surprised to see him being very supportive of that industry. And again, I think it reflects his Illinois roots, which that is a state like West Virginia, very dependent on coal and part of it for the economy.
Jeff, we've heard a lot of talk about Nancy Pelosi being quick out of the gate first week of January with another 100 hours agenda, a part of which may include additional restrictions or changes in the tax code aimed at the big oil companies.
Yes.
And using some of that revenue, I presume, to focus on renewables and alternative energy research. Can you give us a little preview of that?
Sure. The speaker will undoubtedly come forward with another 100-hour agenda, and we expect it to complement Senator Obama, President-elect Obama's 100-day agenda. I think many folks in the oil industry think that the Democratic leadership of the House may be looking at them as a giant ATM machine, and that they have the code to just press the button and start pulling money out. I think the industry is legitimately concerned about whether they'll be asked to pay for the Obama-Biden plan or the Pelosi 100 hour agenda. So I think there is a legitimate basis for concern, but at the same time, the industry would like to see some things done, and I think there is a basis to find common ground. I think you mentioned at the outset that the price of at the pump has gone down. You paid significantly less yesterday. I think what that means in the end is that we may not be looking at a windfall profits tax. Yes, the industry is still reporting record profits, but by early next year, those may well be a thing of the past, and that will at least reduce the pressure for windfall profits tax, something this country tried 2 decades ago and that didn't work then and is no more likely to work now.
It doesn't seem like a good time to be penalizing the few companies that are reporting record profits.
Right, but it also, if you're short on revenues and you've got a handy ATM machine, the temptation to use it will certainly be there.
Yeah, they can pull out probably more than the $300 maximum per
yes.
day.
Yes, I think they have an extra couple zeros on that.
Exactly. You've talked a lot about oil. One of the places where the agendas start to conflict a little bit is when you get into CAFE standards, talk about raising mileage standards for automobiles
right.
when the American automobile industry is in such financial straits. Can you tell us a little bit about where you see that going?
That is, you're right, the Obama-Biden plan does call for an increase of 4% per year in CAFE standards. I don't think that's going to happen. I think that Congress, having just last December established very aggressive new standards for the industry to meet, they now have to meet a combined car and truck target of 35 miles per gallon by 2020. That is a very ambitious undertaking, would have been ambitious if the industry was in good financial health. Given its current struggles, I cannot imagine that Congress would increase fuel economy standards even further. I think the scope now on Capitol Hill has to be, how do we help these companies survive so that they can bring to market the new advanced technology vehicles that everybody would like to see on the road.
Jeff, real fast, I've got about 30 seconds left. Some departments are run out of the White House. Some it really matters to be a secretary of such and such. It seems like this is going to be an agenda that's run directly out of the White House. Does it matter much who the Secretary of Energy
is? Oh, sure. The Secretary will be responsible for helping implement the policy, but given that Senator O'Biden and Biden and Obama put together such a comprehensive plan, I think they'll the ones have the lead.
All right, we've been joined by Jeff Turner. We'll be back in just a minute to talk about financial services and the economic recovery. You're listening to Capital Thinking Radio.
All we talk about is money. Call us toll-free, 866-472-5790, and talk to the experts. We talk money all the time. Voice America Business.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
From K Street to Wall Street to LaSalle Street, the Patton Boggs team knows how to pull off big business transactions. Come hear what we know. Patton Boggs covers the world.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
The same firm that's been navigating the government maze for more than 4 decades is also the same firm that can help you protect your most important assets. Whether it's a valuable patent, an important copyright, or your next big idea, Patton Boggs is committed to protecting your intellectual property.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Interrogatories.
Prima facie.
Pleadings.
Motion for summary judgment.
E-discovery.
Affirmative defense.
Stipulations.
Ex parte.
Amicus brief.
Subpoena.
Litigation is confusing. Trust the litigation team at Patton Boggs to make sense of it all.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hey, out of my way!
Welcome to Washington Gridlock. Patton Boggs' legal team can make sense of it all. We know how Washington works. We've been sorting it out for the past 46 years. We have what it takes. Straight, unfiltered, Patton Boggs. We deliver the insights you need to stay on top of your game.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
The Internet's only all business and financial radio network, Voice America Business.
From Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's K-O-Neill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, good afternoon. Welcome back to Capital Thinking. We're joined by our frequent guest, Micah Green, from law firm of Patton Boggs, where he is the head of the financial services policy practice. And Mike is also the former president of a couple of association players in the financial services world. Micah, welcome back to the show. We might just get you a permanent guest seat at the rate the economic situation continues to dominate the issues in Washington. And I want to kind of start off with a big picture question, Micah. One of our colleagues said something that really has struck home for me, and that is that it literally since the fall of Lehman Brothers, 3 months ago, the financial center of the world has moved from New York City to Washington, D.C. Can you talk a little bit about that and about how you see a new administration sort of solidifying Washington, D.C. as the new financial capital of the world?
Kevin, let me try. The fact is when Lehman Brothers declared bankruptcy, I think it was on September 14th or so, all roads led to Wall Street, and I think when Lehman Brothers went down, it showed the interrelationship between financial institutions, because days after that, AIG was faced with tremendous capital pressure, even though they had very viable business lines with huge amounts of capital, and then the next day, there was a run on the money market funds, because Lehman Brothers commercial paper, which had been highly rated, albeit in a volatile industry, began to be downgraded, and there was a movement out of money market funds exceeding $80 billion, and the federal government had to step up to guarantee money market funds so they wouldn't go under. And then I think the cascading event which led to the passage of the congressional approved TARP program, which the Treasury Department is now implementing. So the next administration coming in is really going to have a major job on three aspects. Number one, continued execution of the TARP program, which means looking at the TARP program, what is already working, what is not working, where can it be changed, where can it be expanded, using the authority they have under that act, or going to the Congress for more. Secondly, they need to look at, they need to recognize that congressional oversight is already beginning on this program, because the Congress held their nose and voted for this thing. As I like to say, they gave a pint or a quart of blood to vote for this thing, and now they're going to be out for a pound of flesh. And part of that,
some of them
gave
up their congressional seats Tuesday over this.
Absolutely. I think, you know, the members of Congress that just won or lost their reelection realized that Main Street has a slightly different view of this thing than Wall Street. When Congress voted on this, they kind of concluded that this was a bailout of Wall Street. It really was a bailout of the entire financial system, which everyone should care about, but it still had to be explained as to why they voted for a $750 billion bailout of Wall Street.
Mike, I interrupted you. You were on part two of a three-step
process. No, that's
process.
Okay. Part three is that continuing on the pound of flesh. It's not just oversight of the TARP program. It's radical reform and scrutiny of what happened here and whether or not the regulatory structure governing our financial markets needs to be completely transformed.
That's a good segue. I woke up this morning and the headline here on my Wall Street Journal is Democrats eye tighter regulation in finance, and there's a couple of ominous quotes from Chuck Schumer about we need a new system of regulation, and Barney Frank from Financial Services is talking about creating a systemic risk regulator, which sounds like a new federal agency to oversee these things. Can you talk a little bit about how you see that step three proceeding? What are the next logical things?
Sure. In the interest of bipartisanship, I think whoever was elected on Tuesday, you'd be seeing the same headlines, Kevin.
Right. I think that's right.
Yeah, I mean, even this Treasury Department issued in March a blueprint for modernization of the financial regulatory structure where they talked about merging the CFTC and the SEC, where they talked about a systemic risk regulator. But I do think that the Congress is going to get to work very quickly on completing the review of what happened and then moving quickly with the new administration to develop serious reforms. And really you have to look at it two different ways. Regulation is about protecting investors, real people who invest in marketplaces, who put their money in banks, and they're affected by this, particularly with the decline of the stock market. But there's also
Mrs. O'Neill Baines when she opens her 401k statement and her 529 for the kids.
Absolutely. It's funny. I've had a situation where within 1 hour, my son called me worried about, and he's just started working. My son worried about his meager 401k, and my mother-in-law worried about her retirement. It's hitting everyone. But the other thing too is, whether or not there are risks to the overall system. And who should be watching the store? I think there's been a big unease about what's going on in the marketplace at the sophisticated institutional level, not so much about, you know, being a chaperone for their investment decisions, but making sure that what they're doing doesn't roll over and hit other parts of the entire marketplace.
I want to ask you one more question on the financial services world, then I want to shift to tax before we run out on time on this segment, Michael. But I've seen a lot of chatter in the last week or two among elected officials and talking heads on the media outlets about the TARP program and whether or not banks are using the money the way they're supposed to, whether or not they're supposed to be sitting on it so that they can rebuild their own internal assets, or whether or not the money the feds were giving them is supposed to be loaned out to Main Street. There seems to be a sharp disagreement about what the right thing is to do there.
Well, that gets to the oversight question, because the Congress is asking those questions. As the capital purchase program is being implemented and agreements are being written between the Treasury and these financial institutions, the real question is, should they use the money for lending, which is really the intention here, to infuse the system with more money, or should they be using the money to facilitate consolidating institutions and creating a more efficient environment? I think the populist view is any capital that goes from the Federal Treasury to a financial institution should be lent out in the system. Is that the right answer from a technical standpoint? Maybe, maybe not, but it is going to be scrutinized.
It seems like the challenge is if, you know, these banks were overextended to begin with, and then the feds lend them money and they turn around and put that money right back out into the system, how have we improved their situation?
Because you've improved their balance sheet, and right now they need the improvement.
Fair enough. Well, let's shift to tax for a couple of minutes, Micah. Barack Obama, I think one of the reasons he got elected was his strong message on providing a tax cut for 95% of Americans, those making under $250,000 a year. And it seems like that is about to hit the reality of how do you pay for it and how do you structure it in this time of economic crisis. Can you talk a little bit about how you expect the Obama administration to work with Congress in rolling out their tax agenda?
Absolutely. I think there's a couple things at work. Number one, an overall tax policy review by the Obama administration, looking at the current tax code, and I think what you heard out of the campaign is that they believe that the tax cuts that were enacted under Bush's administration were far too targeted to the upper income or corporations, and he wants to reorder those priorities so that more of the tax cuts go to the middle class. But you have an intervening factor here. You have a recession. You have an economy that needs stimulus. So I think first out of the block is you'll probably see some stimulus. Now, whether or not his tax cut will be implemented as part of an economic stimulus package is very important, because if it's about stimulating a recessionary economy, paying for it is not going to be a question for today. It's going to be the question for tomorrow. So I think first out of the block will be economic stimulus, which could include some tax issues, could include some infrastructure issues, but overall, within the next year or two, you will see an Obama administration look at tax equity as the Bush tax cuts begin to expire by the end of 2010.
And small businessmen seem to be sort of particularly a twitter about whether or not they fall in that 95% or that 5%. But I also heard Senator Obama on the campaign trail talk a lot about lending programs to prop up small business in these trying times, and also more targeted tax cuts. Do you see anything in particular that they might focus on, either as part of the stimulus or in that down-the-line phase that you just talked about?
Yeah, I clearly both parties realize that the real job creators out there on Main Street are the small businesses. And I think Obama, President-elect Obama on the campaign trail, made the point that most small businesses are not making more than $250,000 a year, and that, in fact, they will get a tax cut under this. But I think you're going to see a review of lots of programs to encourage the growth and building of small businesses, and building upon some of the programs that are currently out there in the SBA. And, in fact, even within the TARP program, there is a targeted nature of trying to get small businesses engaged in this whole Treasury effort.
Well, and I got about a minute left, Micah. What about a value-added tax as a new revenue source? And also, does Democratic control mean the end of the flat tax or national sales tax as a policy issue?
I think it'll be very hard to enact comprehensive tax reform. I think you could see a lot of jiggering to create a different form of priorities and equity within the tax code. But comprehensive tax reform, where you create a VAT tax and replace the income tax, is probably going to be very difficult to do in the next several years. And a flat tax, which is another form of change of tax, number one, competes with state sales taxes, and number two, is viewed as much more regressive. Now, you can structure it in less regressive ways, but I don't see it as a viable option right now. One thing to keep an eye on, though, is going to be the Social Security tax, because in the campaign it was suggested that the Social Security tax, which is now capped to the first $102,000 of income, whether or not that cap will be changed, or whether or not people making above that cap will be asked to pay any more Social Security tax, which is in essence the flattest tax of all.
Right, but raising that tax would have a pretty significant impact on high earners, many of whom would still fall under that $250,000 umbrella. Right, $202,000 earners.
Convince the public that they need to step up to the plate at this time. That's where presidential leadership will be needed.
Well, interesting times. Micah, as always, thanks for joining us. We'll be back in a moment to talk about healthcare policy. You're listening to Capital Thinking Radio on the Voice America Business Network.
Money, money, up-to-date business and financial news. Money, money, call now and get the financial information you need. 866-472-5790. 866-472-5790. Voice America Business.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hola. Konnichiwa.
Bonjour.
Hello.
From Anchorage to Abu Dhabi.
Marhaba.
From Denver to Doha.
Ciao.
Patton Boggs makes business transactions the world over.
Oi.
Rely on our insights for your next deal. Patton Boggs, the international business team. Straight, unfiltered, Patton Boggs.
Stewart Pape Attorney at Law is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
What's your name worth? The loss of a single patent, trademark, or copyright can cost millions. Make sure your intellectual property is protected. Trust Patton Boggs to manage and protect your most important assets.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
If you find yourself under the Klieg lights of a government investigation, you want experience on your side. Patton Boggs has 46 years of it. We've handled some of the biggest white-collar crime cases. Put that experience to work for you.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hear ye, hear ye. The House will come to order.
Having trouble sorting out what's going on Capitol Hill? Patton Boggs can cut through it all. We've got the insight, the know-how, the connections to navigate. Patton Boggs, straight, unfiltered. Patton Boggs, a bipartisan voice with knowledge and 46 years of experience.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
From the stock market floor to your laptop, we are Voice America Business.
Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, welcome back to Capital Thinking. I want to give a good grilling to our next guest, so if you want to call in, our number again is 866-472-5790. We're going to talk healthcare now for a few minutes, and we're joined by one of the leading healthcare public policy experts in Washington, D.C. That's John Jonas, who's the head of the healthcare public policy group at the law firm of Patton Boggs. John, welcome to your maiden voyage on Capital Thinking.
Well, thank you very much, Kevin. Thanks for having me on the show.
And I know that you're sitting with there with a big grin because you are a happy, content Democrat who have seen your party sweep to power here and now has the ability to create a significant change in the healthcare arena. And I want to start by saying I thought Obama, one of the reasons he probably won was he ran one of the most brilliant commercials that showed a spectrum, and at one end was government-managed health care, and the other end was fend for yourself. And then he said he was in the glorious middle where he was going to mix the best of both worlds to provide a better health care system for us. Can you walk us through, John, what you see as sort of the major elements of the Obama-Biden health care plan that we're all going to become so familiar with in the months ahead?
Sure, Kevin. What President-elect Obama intends to create is what's called a National Health Insurance Exchange Program. This program is pretty similar to something that's been up and running in Massachusetts, and that's an entity through which individuals can purchase health insurance, either a public plan, so there would be sort of a government plan, a base plan, or a private health insurance plan. These would be qualified, meaning they'd have to meet certain requirements. And insurers who participate in this exchange would be required to offer coverage on a guaranteed issue basis, which means regardless of health conditions, everybody would be able to purchase it, and there would be certain guidelines for premiums and premium increases. And this exchange is really backed up by what we've all come to know as a play or pay requirement, and that is a mandate, not the most politically popular word, but a mandate to require employers to offer health insurance to their employees or to pay a tax to help fund the government's cost of providing health insurance for those who are not covered. And then there would be a series of subsidies for small businesses to help cover the cost of their participation in this health insurance exchange. And by doing that, President-elect Obama hopes to provide and assure broad-based health insurance coverage for Americans.
Well, that sounds like the Obama plan will potentially have a lot more responsibility for the private market to undertake in terms of this pay-or-play provision that seems that I know is central to the Massachusetts plan and also sounds central to the Obama plan. If you're a listener out there and you run a small business or you're in management or a director of a small or large business, allay my concerns, John, and tell me how the private industry is going to have a voice in this process going forward.
Well, I think the good things for private business, especially small businesses, look, you're going to know that you can get a plan out there. People have got to sell you insurance and can't refuse to cover you because you have a couple of workers who are particularly sick or have particularly bad health conditions. Two, you know that you will get the sort of group rate, so to speak, since everybody will be buying through this one national health insurance exchange. Private insurers who participate will have to essentially offer kind of one price nationwide. And while I suppose if you had a very young workforce and a very healthy one, you could get maybe it a little bit cheaper, you'll have the protection. If you don't have a good profile of having the cost kind of controlled a little bit. And finally, President-elect Obama has talked about something that Senator Kerry also talked about, which is a protection for catastrophic costs. So it's possible that private employer plans would be capped, let's say, I'm picking a number, but this is a number that's often talked about, $50,000 in liability per insured life. So there would be a reinsurance plan that would pick up the really high cost patients. And often the big cost driver in healthcare and of course therefore also in health insurance is a couple of those few outliers.
The sickest people in the company.
Very sick and very expensive.
Gotcha. Well, let's talk about a couple of the elephants in the room. You know, I think a lot of people will be concerned in this economic crisis time about how changing the system will impact their pocketbook, and also how do we pay for the proposed changes here? What are you seeing and hearing on the Hill about those issues?
Yeah, it's that is the big elephant in the room. Where do you find the money for this? It's expected to cost somewhere between $50 to $65 billion a year to implement this kind of program. There's sort of two sets of answers. One, there is kind of the hidden tax out there that we're all paying for the uninsured, and we all know how expensive hospital bills are and many procedures are. And a lot of that is because hospitals and other providers kind of jack up the price for the, 20 or 30% who receive services but really can't pay the bill. So to some extent, we're a little bit paying for that. I know maybe people think that's a cute answer, but it's worth keeping that in mind. During the campaign, President-elect Obama has talked about imposing taxes on those over $250,000, bringing back the rates that were there before the Bush tax cuts went into effect. And doing that would provide enough money to provide these kinds of benefits. There may be competing demands on those kinds of dollars, but it will be expensive, and finding the money will be challenging. It's also worth remembering we have somewhere around a $1.6 trillion healthcare system, and there's a lot of money sloshing around in that system, I think, that can be used more efficiently.
The ever-present waste, fraud, and abuse, right?
Well, there are some inefficiencies in the system.
Well, let me ask you about another big elephant in the room and perhaps a place where there is some inefficiency, and that's Medicare. It seems like trying to fix the private system without addressing Medicare will leave many of the same problems behind. Are we looking at one big omnibus fix here, or are things going to be tackled piece by piece? And if so, when does Medicare get to the head of the line?
Well, when you get a tough question, you always say, Kevin, that's a good question. Try and move on. That's a very tough question. Medicare is the biggest cost driver in the federal budget. It dwarfs Social Security. All the projections show that it's relatively out of control. And I think it's very fair for people to say, look, show me that you can get this giant entitlement program under some kind of restraint before you move into another expanded system. This wouldn't be quite an entitlement program, but certainly would have many of the attributes to it. I think that's a very fair demand. It'll be interesting to see if this administration tackles Medicare reform as part of this process or separate to it. I do anticipate that at some point during the Obama tenure, they will, in fact, try and wrestle Medicare to the ground, and that will involve probably some limitations on access to the program, probably some higher copays for the participants, probably some higher taxes, and some controls on utilization.
Let me jump to the other end of the spectrum and ask you, I've heard a lot of speculation that one of the first things that will be out of the gate in the first 100 days of an Obama administration will be revisiting the question of SCHIP, the State Health Insurance Children's Health Insurance Program that President Bush vetoed and therefore that Congress had passed sort of a patch. Tell us what you see happening with SCHIP.
Yeah, as reforming Medicare is so incredibly difficult, expanding SCHIP is really pretty simple. As President-elect Obama has been said this many times during the campaign, is very committed to expanding coverage for children, a very successful program, not an overly expensive program. There's another program out there, Medicare Advantage, where the government intentionally overpaid to get seniors into a Medicare managed care program and is paying for that 110, 112, 115% over what they pay regular for a regular Medicare patient. So there's relatively easy money to find to offset the cost of expanding the SCHIP program. I think that'll be done within the first 6 months of the new Obama administration, maybe even earlier than 6 months.
I think I got time for one more really quick question, John, and that is drug regulation and drug reimportation. You talked about universal pricing a little bit earlier. Do you see the drug companies facing the prospect of drug reimportation from Canada and lower prices?
I don't think reimportation, it's gotten a little discredited with some of the import problems we've had with China, but I do see attempts to regulate drug prices for name brand drugs coming back in a very serious way, but not probably through reimportation.
And also, what about allowing the federal government, which is currently prohibited from negotiating for bulk prices with drug companies? Do you think that they'll be allowed to do that in the future?
Yeah, I think technically that's a little challenging given the way the Medicare Part D program is set up. But either directly or indirectly, I think the government is going to get involved in the price negotiations on the Medicare Part D program.
Thanks for joining us. We're going to be back in just a moment with our final segment of this week's episode of Capital Thinking.
Thank you, Kevin.
Stocks, bonds, 401ks, investments, refinancing. We can help you. Call now toll-free, 866-472-5790, 866-472-5790. Voice America Business.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
From K Street to Wall Street to LaSalle Street, the Patton Boggs team knows how to pull off big business transactions. Come hear what we know. Patton Boggs covers the world.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
What's your name worth?
The loss of a single patent, trademark, or copyright can cost millions. Make sure your intellectual property is protected. Trust Patent Boggs to manage and protect your most important assets.
Stuart Pape Attorney at Law is responsible for the content of this ad. Patent Boggs Principal Office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patent Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Interrogatories.
Prima facie.
Pleadings.
Motion for summary judgment.
E-discovery.
Affirmative defense.
Stipulations.
Ex parte.
Amicus brief.
Subpoena.
Litigation is confusing. Trust the litigation team at Patton Boggs to make sense of it all.
Stuart Pape Attorney at Law is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs Principal Office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hear ye, hear ye. The House will come to order.
Having trouble sorting out what's going on Capitol Hill? Patton Boggs can cut through it all. We've got the insight, the know-how, the connections to navigate. Patton Boggs, straight, unfiltered. Patton Boggs, a bipartisan voice with knowledge and 46 years of experience.
Stuart Pape Attorney at Law is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs Principal Office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
The bottom line in business. Voice America Business.
Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, we've had some great guests so far this afternoon. Talk a little bit about healthcare policy, energy policy, and the continuing challenges that we face as a government and as a people in the regulation of the economic world in the face of this financial crisis. And now we're going to just talk a little bit about sort of the aftermath of the election. As I said at the top of the hour, you got folks in Washington and around the country who are just ecstatic about the election of President Obama. I think in many ways this is the Democratic version of Ronald Reagan in terms of the enthusiasm and love that people have for him at the very initial start of his campaign. I thought he made a very graceful entrance onto the stage in his acceptance speech on Tuesday night and set a very positive tone for people to be involved and engaged in this administration. Now, what's interesting is the honeymoon doesn't last very long in today's 24/7 media world. Right before the show started, I got a poll email from Rasmussen Polls that shows they're already taking Barack Obama's approval ratings, and just one day into his transition period, there's already 40% of Americans strongly approve of his transition performance so far, and 32%, one out of three Americans, strongly disapprove of his transition performance so far. Really? Let's see. Yesterday, Obama got up, he went to the Y, and he played some basketball with some friends, he worked out, and then he had meetings all day with people to talk about the transition. I'm not sure what one out of three Americans could see wrong with that. It just sort of tells you how polarizing an environment he already faces, that so few of us are willing to give him a chance to operate on our best behalf. We're already leaping to judgment that things are going to go wrong. I want to commend President Bush. He's doing the right things with the transition. He got out there yesterday and he talked a little bit about his desire to help Obama get acclimated. He's invited him to the White House. They're doing everything they can to quickly clear top staffers and administration officials with background checks so that Obama can hit the ground running when he gets to Washington on January 20th. That's the right thing to do, and I'd like to see President Bush get a little more credit for that. So what's one of the favorite games here in Washington in this transition period? Well, lots of people call Barack Obama the chosen one. Well, right now, tens of thousands of Democrats across the country, people who have been strong supporters of the chosen one's campaign, are waiting for the chosen one to call them, offer them a spot to be Secretary of State. That's what John Kerry's waiting by the phone for, or Director of Health and Human Secretary of Health and Human Services, where maybe Howard Dean is waiting for that phone call. And go down the line, and people are waiting to be Deputy Director of this and Assistant Secretary of that. And that's one of the favorite parlor games of Washington, is to find out which of your friends has gotten the call. We don't know a lot of people who've gotten the call, but we know one, and that's Rahm Emanuel, congressman from Chicago, former senior official in the Clinton administration, worked in the White House, was rumored to be one of the people that the characters of West Wing was modeled after on that TV series, that great TV series from the 90s. Rahm Emanuel's been offered the chance to be Barack Obama's chief of staff. And that seems to be a very wise choice on a number of levels. Again, he's got great White House experience, and he's got great experience. He's the number four person in the majority leadership in the House of Representatives. So he understands how Congress works. He's got a great network of relationships with the people in the majority in both chambers. And it seems like he's got the work ethic and the hard-nosed attitude to run a pretty tight ship for Obama. And if there's one thing I think most people can agree, whether or not they like Obama, is the guy knows how to set up an organization and let it run to peak efficiency. He certainly proved that with his campaign this past 2 years. Looks like he's setting up to do the same thing in the White House. Now, the downside of Rahm Emanuel is he's a very, very partisan Democrat, and someone who's worked hard to get into some high-profile disputes with Republicans. And to the extent that Obama wants to get to post-partisanship in Washington, he's going to need to rein in Rahm Emanuel's more partisan tendencies if, in fact, he wants to convince Republicans that he's sincere about the desire to work together. So I think that's very interesting. People are expecting Rahm to accept or decline in the next day or two, and the dominoes will fall from there. I think Rahm Emanuel could be a great chief of staff for Barack Obama. I find very interesting the dumping on Sarah Palin by the McCain staff in the last 48 hours. There's all kinds of rumors on the news about she didn't know Africa was a continent and she wasn't prepared for this or that, and I don't really understand the need for campaign staff to make it all about them. If only the boss had listened to me. Well, the boss didn't listen to you. He picked Sarah Palin, and by all accounts, she was a net plus to the McCain campaign. She got more people at her rallies than John McCain got at his. There's a reason McCain traveled so much with her. It wasn't because he didn't want her off on his own. It was because he didn't want lots of stories about how she was drawing 20,000 in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, and he was drawing 5,000 in Raleigh, North Carolina. She is a net plus to his ticket, and carping about her now doesn't do anybody any good. It doesn't help the party rebuild. And I have a question for those Republican staffers. What did they expect? Why did they stick to it? If they felt so strongly about it, they should have gotten out. And, this carping now is just, it's unbelievably unprofessional on all of their parts. One last point about Palin. Whether or not she was an effective vice president, the woman helped save two Republican seats in the state of Alaska, where Ted Stevens is holding on to his Senate seat right now, very narrow margin, some votes still being counted, and Don Young looks like he's won his House seat. And without her, those seats probably would have gone down. One other thing on the McCain campaign. A lot of people talk about the what I think is a myth, that McCain was the best that Republicans had to offer, to which I say this. Which Republican couldn't have lost North Carolina, Virginia, Ohio, Indiana, and Colorado in this election? Certainly Mitt Romney, if he run, could have lost those states. If Mike Huckabee had run for president, we probably could have lost those states. In virtually no place did John McCain outperform President Bush 4 years ago. So to say he was the best the Republicans had to offer doesn't really seem to do very much for his case in history. There's a lot of talk in Washington these last couple days about leadership changes. If Rahm Emanuel leaves, he'll be giving up a choice position in the House leadership, the number four position where he's the Democratic caucus chairman. And more importantly, Rahm Emanuel looked to be in line to be the next Speaker of the House because Nancy Pelosi and the Majority Leader Steny Hoyer and the Majority Whip Jim Clyburn are all folks that are in their 60s and 70s and probably aren't going to spend another 10 or 12 years in Congress to move up the ranks. Rahm Emanuel was thought to be a Speaker in waiting. If he vacates, there'll be a lot of competition to go after that spot and become the young gun who might be the next speaker in waiting on the Democratic side. The same is true on the Republican side, where John Boehner looks like he's going to hold on to his job as the House Minority Leader, but people are jockeying for position. Roy Blunt has decided not to run for the second-ranking spot. The minority whip, Eric Cantor from Virginia, looks like he's going to run for that unopposed. Some other leadership positions are under a great deal of stress, a lot of people running for those positions. And so as you hear about that, keep in mind they're really running to be the next Speaker of the House when their party's in control. On either the Democratic side, when Pelosi steps down, or on the Republican side, if and when they take over the majority. Now, we're going to be back next week. We're really going to focus hard again on some of these issues about where we're going in the future, what the 111th Congress is going to do in January. We're also going to spend some time next week talking about the lame duck session that Congress is going to have the week before Thanksgiving. We think that they'll have a very productive week trying to get some things done, including perhaps an economic stimulus package. So I hope you'll join us then. Until then, you've been listening to Capital Thinking Radio here on the Voice America Business Network.
Thank you for joining us for Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. We hope to have you join us again for more insight from Washington. We're here every Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, noon Eastern, on the Voice America Business Network.